tiny little things. "I just hope you don't spill any of them," Oberman said. "That won't be a problem. If they're exposed to ultraviolet light, they're disabled, and there's plenty of UV and sunlight." "Yeah, but if you're moving them at night," Rivera suggested, "maybe we should schedule moving the nanos only during daylight hours." Grant thought about it for a few seconds. "Makes sense, Josie. Probably unnecessary, but an extra safety precaution wouldn't hurt." "So how are the bugs going to work once you've got them at the sites?" Oberman asked. "We build temporary roofs over each site. No big deal, just lightweight honeycomb metal sheets. That'll protect the sites against incoming micrometeoroids, as well as solar UV. And once the scopes are completed, we can take down the coverings, right?" "Right," said Grant. "The nanomachine's work will be finished by then. They'll be deactivated." Oberman rubbed his long jaw as he asked, "You're claiming that those nanobugs will produce mirrors shaped to the tolerances you need?" "Probably not. We might have to do some final polishing." "That means hauling the measuring equipment to the craters," Rivera said.
"To Cellini first," Grant said. "We'll have to check the demo mirror that Cardenas is building there."
"Yeah, but sooner or later you'll have to lug the polishing equipment out to each one of the craters," said Oberman. "Christ, you'll have to haul the whole turntable from here to there. Three theres."
"Maybe," Grant conceded. "But the turntable's a lot more robust than the damned mirrors. Should be no sweat to haul it back and forth." Oberman looked totally unconvinced.
"That's a lot of outdoor work," Rivera said.
"I know," said Grant. "That's why we've got to automate the work as much as possible. We need to adapt the robots to do as much of the job as they can."
"Robots," Oberman muttered. "You'll wind up spending more time maintaining the damned robots than anything else."
"I'm going to put Harvey in charge of robot maintenance," Grant told him. "His foot ought to be fine by the time we get started on this." Josie nodded, accepting Grant's decision. Oberman looked cynically doubtful.
"Okay, then," Grant said. "Now, the first thing we need to do is get those roads scraped out."
Once Grant had finished with Josie, he walked down to Farside's little cafeteria. The place was nearly empty. Dinner hour had long passed. As he stood before one of the food dispensing machines, wondering which of the meager packaged meals he wanted to select, Trudy Yost came up beside him.
"Hi," he said, happily surprised.
"I didn't see you come in."
She gave him a grin.
"You were studying the machine's display as if your life depended on it."
He shrugged.
"Well, it does, sort of."
"Don't you think so?"
"I guess so, if you put it that way."
"The ulcer let you go?" Grant asked.
"No way. I'm here to pick up meals for the four of us and bring them back to the prof's office. We're eating in there."
"Oh."
"The professor's burying Dr. Palmquist with facts and figures," Trudy said. "The poor guy's eyes glazed over an hour ago, but the prof is just plowing ahead, telling him how we're going to produce images of New Earth before anybody else can."
Grant banged one of the buttons at random and stooped down to grab the package that slid into the tray at the bottom of the machine. Her voice softening, Trudy said,
"I'm sorry he cut you off like that."
He straightened up and looked into her gentle green eyes.
"That's okay. I'm used to it. I'm just a crummy engineer, far as he's concerned. Dirt under my fingernails."
Trudy said,
"You're much more important than that, Grant."
"It's nice of you to say so."
For a moment, they stood facing each other, close enough to touch. Feeling awkward, almost like a teenager on his first date, Grant shifted his dinner package from one hand to the other.
"Maybe we could have dinner together sometime," he heard himself say.
Trudy smiled at him.
"That'd be great."
"My quarters aren't all that much, but I could microwave a meal for you. It would be more private than the cafeteria here."
"I guess,"
she said a trifle uncertainly.
"I got some old movies, Hollywood classics.
Or we could watch video from Cellini."
"Sure," said Trudy. "But right now I've got to get dinners for the professor, Mr. McClintock, and Dr. Palmquist."
"And yourself," Grant added.
She laughed.
"Yep, and myself."
After a heartbeat's pause, she said,
"But I'll look forward to dinner with you. Real soon."
"Sure," he said.
"Real soon." Crater Mendeleev. The weeks zipped past before Grant realized it. Palmquist returned to Cellini, with Ulrich falling all over himself to please the Swede, and promising to send him the first images of New Earth that the Farside Observatory obtained. Grant's days were long and busy, juggling the road-building work with planning the construction jobs that were needed at the three crater sites, and coordinating Cardenas's work on the sample mirror that her nanomachines were making at Cellini. One of the tasks facing his team of engineers and technicians was to transport the materials for a protective roof to the crater Mendeleev, 750 kilometers from the Farside facility. The load was too much for one of the short-range rocket hoppers that Farside kept on hand, and not big enough to warrant calling for a lobber mission from Cellini. So Grant decided to send a tractor out to Mendeleev, and he decided to make the run himself. He was driving the tractor up the slumped, gentle slope of the mountains ringing Mendeleev crater, with one of his team, Sherrod Phillips, sitting beside him. They had driven continuously for more than 26 hours, taking turns sleeping in their spacesuits inside the tractor's cramped cab. The road they had built here at Mendeleev had only a few switchbacks in it because the area Grant had picked across the ring wall was relatively low with an easy grade. "We could have gotten that damned mirror up this mountain with no sweat," Grant told himself as he steered the tractor slowly along the smoothed road. "If it hadn't slid off the road back at Farside, we could have gotten it up here and into Mendeleev, okay?" "Yeah," a mocking voice in his head sneered. "And if you'd put wings on the mirror, you could have flown it here, wise ass." The two men were in their spacesuits, even though the tractor's cab was pressurized. It was enclosed with a thin metal roof and glass steel sides that gave them a layer of protection against the radiation out there in the lunar vacuum. Safety regulations insisted that they wear the protective suits, even though they could have ridden inside the cab in their shirt sleeves, in theory. It was still night, and would be for another week. The universe hung up in the dark sky, uncountable myriads of stars, hard, cold points of light, unblinking. No earth up there, no warmth or familiar comfort. The horizon was brutally near, a slash where the hard, familiar world of lunar rock and dust ended like the edge of a cliff, plunging into the infinite, uncaring expanse of stars. Grant topped the ringwall mountain and started down the interior slope. In the distance, almost at the horizon, he could see the square, flat, concrete foundation that had been laid out for the telescope mirror. It was his imagination, he knew, but the low slabs already looked old, worn, covered with lunar dust. Sherry Phillips was sitting in the tractor's right-hand seat, encased in a bulky spacesuit. Grant couldn't see his face through the tinted glass steel of his bubble helmet, but he heard the engineer say, "So what do you think of this new kid?"
"New kid?" Grant asked.
"Yeah, the Ulster's new assistant, Trudy."
"She's an astronomer."
"She's a good looker. Cute."
Grant knew that Phillips was married, but his wife was back Earthside with their two children. Phillips was a sharp engineer, a reliable man in the field, but possessed of a roving eye. Farside gossip claimed that he and Josie Rivera had had a fling several months back. "Forget it," he told Phillips. "The ulcer would have a stroke if you came onto her." In his helmet speakers he heard Phillips chuckle. "Hell, Grant, I wouldn't tell the ulcer about it. Or ask his permission, for that matter." Grant shook his head. "Better stay clear of her. Don't cause problems." "Yeah, maybe you're right." But Phillips didn't sound convinced. Grant drove the tractor across the crater's wide floor to the telescope site. Then he and Phillips stepped out onto the dusty rock-strewn ground. The tractor was carrying sheets of honeycomb metal that they would erect to form a roof over the foundation. It also carried a pair of slim cylindrical-shaped robots that were supposed to do the actual construction work. "I'll activate Mike and Ike," said Phillips, walking around to the rear of the tractor. He was the robotics expert on Grant's little team of engineers and technicians. Like almost all humans, he anthropomorphized the machines he worked with. Mike and Ike, Grant thought. What'll he call the other pair, the ones we're going to bring to Korolev? Punch and Judy? Using a handheld remote controller, Phillips stirred the robots to life and began checking them out, while Grant set up the ramp they would roll down once they were ready to go to work.
"Got a bad fuse on Ike," Phillips muttered.
Grant looked up at the tractor bed where Phillips stood between the two shoulder-tall robots.
"Damn it, those machines were checked out at Farside. How can they have a bad fuse?" He sensed Phillips trying to shrug inside his bulky spacesuit.
It happens, Grant. Murphy's Law.
Who did the checkout? Grant demanded.